Well, good evening, everyone. We're actually speaking without microphones, so I'd just say to the other panellists, try and speak up as much as you can. Shout. Although I think the acoustics are sounding pretty good in here. It should be. This is the new building that I think a lot of people who probably know the LSE from many years ago, who haven't been back, have been a little bit surprised at what's happened here. Yanis, I think you said you couldn't quite believe it. It had been a few years since you've been here, and I think we're all still trying to get used to this. I ventured up to the sixth floor for the first time today. It's about the highest I've got. Yeah. Yes, very nice. So overall, we're still finding our way around. So this is a bit of a change from Cowdray House, which I think many of you probably remember. But thank you so much, everyone, for coming this evening. Really, really delighted to be hosting this evening's event. For anyone who doesn't know, my name is James Kerr-Lindsay, and I'm visiting professor here at LSE, which is our research unit on Southeast Europe that we have as part of the European Institute. I'm particularly pleased because this evening it's a chance to officially launch here in the UK. I'd like to say it's the first launch that we've done, but in fact it's the second. Prague was the first launch that we did a couple of months ago of our, I think we can call it, wonderful new book, The Politics of Recognition and Engagement. We've got quite a strong panel of presenters this evening, so everyone will sort of go through and present their particular contributions. And Yanis will tell you a little bit about the project, but what I thought I'd do is just start by giving a flavour of, if you like, the intellectual thinking that went into the volume, which was very much work that I had been very interested in questions of recognition, and specifically about this concept of recognition and non-recognition and engagement. So how do countries, entities that don't recognize each other, how can they interact with each other? And this is becoming more and more of a question in international relations, especially for people who work on conflict situations, because there are situations where you would say that, right, even if there isn't a formal diplomatic relationship that can exist, how can we find ways of encouraging greater engagement between parties? But what became very interesting is that we've tended to think of recognition in very binary terms. You either recognize a country or you don't. And if you recognize, you engage with it. And if you don't recognize, you don't engage with it. And Kosovo's been a really interesting case because it became very apparent that sort of binary understanding of recognition just doesn't hold up. The reality is far more complex. And this is what we'll be talking a little bit about this evening and highlighting with the various case studies that we'll do. So we'll cover Germany, UK, Greece, and Poland, which is three of the four cases that I'm going to talk about. And we came up with this understanding that, in actual fact, you've got to sort of understand that even amongst the recognizers, there are some countries which are, if you like, strong recognizers, as we call them. These are countries that have recognized Kosovo and have a lot of interaction with Kosovo. But also then you've got, the soft recognizers. And these are countries which may have recognized Kosovo, but in actual fact, the level of engagement with Kosovo is minimal or very low indeed. And then balanced against that, on the non-recognizers side, you have countries that we call soft non-recognizers and then the hard non-recognizers, or the, was it weak? I'm just trying to remember. I should have written, yes. We've got read the book, and it's all laid out very neatly. Countries that in actual fact have a very, very high degree of interaction with Kosovo, but don't actually formally recognize it. And then right at the end of the scale, the two countries we don't have represented on the panel tonight, the famous Spain and Cyprus, which are the super hard non-recognizers. These are the countries which say, we don't recognize Kosovo and we will have nothing to do with it. And even Cyprus at times, it's sort of ebbed and flowed. There have been times when actually it's sort of warmed a little bit to Pristina and sent over diplomatic teams. But at the moment, I think we can say they're in a pretty hard place when it comes to non-recognition and non-engagement. And so if you like, that's the intellectual grounding for the book. And we hope that actually this model is something that can be applied in other cases, other conflict situations where you've got a country, an entity that isn't necessarily recognised more widely, but you can actually see that there's a myriad of different forms of engagement that can still nevertheless exist. So I think just on that point, I'll leave it and hand it over to Yanis to explain a little bit about the actual genesis and development of the project.
Thank you, James. Pleasure to be at the LSE in this new building. Impressive. So the project started several years ago. We were trying to remember earlier when we met, when was the start of the project, and I think we established that it was 3 years ago. From the outset, I have to stress that this project would not have been possible, at least not in this form, without the support of the Kosovo Foundation for Open Society, and we have a couple of people from the organization here today, and because they made possible somehow the coordination of this team. We had the opportunity through the help of Open Society to visit Kosovo and have our coordination meeting, but also have interviews there. And we also visited Kosovo again when we published the first report before the actual book was published, and we presented, and we had various meetings in Kosovo. So this was a crucial support, financial support, that we had for this project. So as James mentioned, the whole idea was how to move beyond the classic recognition, non-recognition divide, non-recognition distinction. Because obviously this has been exhausted, or at least it has been studied extensively, but there was so much more than the actual, you are either a recognizer or a non-recognizer of Kosovo. We had Agon, and Agon will talk in a minute, who in his chapter, what were different themes that we tried to discuss or cover in the book. So first of all, we had Agon's chapter, which tried to see the empirics of Kosovo organization of foreign policy, but also the practice of foreign policy by Kosovo. So how does a newly independent state develops its foreign policy and its strategy for attaining recognitions by different states. And that was one introductory chapter, so to say, before we moved to studying the case studies. And the cases, of course, there are nine EU member states, and James mentioned how different they were in this as types of state behavior, so to say. So we wanted to see how different member states had, what kind of policy different member states had when it comes to this cardinal foreign policy issue for EU, which is Kosovo's statehood. In fact, one of the most important foreign policy issues since the end of the Cold War, and of course very important for European security also. In that context, of course, as it's obvious from the case of Kosovo, the EU foreign policy, common foreign policy, has not worked, did not work from the beginning. But instead of looking at the failure of common EU foreign policy from the perspective of the EU institutions, the machinery, EU machinery, or the politics in Brussels, although we did study also the politics in Brussels, but from the perspective of the member states. So what we wanted to see was how the decision-making process in each of the nine member states that we have studied took place, how they interacted with other states, how they interacted with Brussels and the various points and developments in the process of how Kosovo crisis evolved and the statehood was declared and so on and so forth. We wanted to see, and we studied in these nine different cases, domestic influences and domestic lobbies for and against recognition, and how different relations with foreign powers worked in each of the case, whether US, Russia, Germany, or the EU as a whole. Various domestic issues, domestic politics, domestic sensitivities that impacted on foreign policy in general, but also specifically, of course, on Kosovo. foreign policy priorities in each of these states, etc. We also took a step back and we tracked the evolution of positions of various member states, of the nine member states, over the entire Yugoslav crisis. So from the end of the Cold War through the Yugoslav wars and the Kosovo war, and then the post-Kosovo war politics, state building in Kosovo, the international community presence in Kosovo, then the declaration of independence up until today. So how the positions of the different countries evolved over all these issues, and of course the debate on recognizing or not, that was one key part of the discussion. We monitored the foreign policy of these member states, and in that we found the nuances which are important, I think. For example, we saw the countries that have recognized reluctantly Kosovo and how they try to keep distance from this, from the country that they themselves have recognized. And then we have countries that have not recognized Kosovo but are not hostile to the idea of Kosovo statehood, so how they try to keep engaged with Kosovo, engaged or even increasingly engaged with Kosovo, even though still not recognizing. And of course, a couple of countries mentioned by James here, especially Spain and Cyprus, who are totally hostile to the idea of Kosovo statehood. So how did these countries develop their policy? Again, in a kind of strange environment, because these countries operate in the European Union in an environment where the vast majority of the member states have recognized Kosovo and are in favor of Kosovo statehood. So they also have to negotiate their position somehow in a difficult environment. Altogether, it was a fascinating mapping, I think, we all think, of policies, of nuances, of gray areas, of diplomacy at its best. At the end, we also assessed the prospects of recognition in the future. We outlined the current, or rather current 2 years ago, although not much have changed in some of the countries, the current state of debate about Kosovo recognition, and we assessed how realistic or not the prospect of actual recognition in the near future is, or whether we can expect policy change in the near future in which countries, if at all. And all that is part of the discussion, especially about with regards to the five non-recognizers. So this is more or less the different themes that we try to cover in the different chapters and overall in the book. Again, I would like to thank KFOS for the unwavering support. I have to stress that it was an academic project supported by Open Society, but without any interference in our work, and I'm very happy. I would like to work more often with organizations that would not want to impose agendas or influence the agendas. And this was made possible through Open Society. And I will give the floor back to James.
Thank you, Yanis. So we'll now move on and cover some of the chapters. I should have introduced you, Yanis, shouldn't I? Really.
I'm Makolas, assistant professor at the University of Macedonia in Thessaloniki, senior.
There is only one Macedonia now.
Yeah. Okay. Still, just to be on the safe side. You know, everybody says I'm very open-minded, being Greek and teaching in Macedonia. So I have to stress it's in Thessaloniki.
And engaging for Kosovo.
Yeah, and senior research fellow at the ELIAMEP think tank in Athens. Yeah, thanks.
And so we'll go straight on to our first or second speaker, Agon Demiahe, who it is a pleasure to have here. Wasn't necessarily easiest, I think, for most people in this room who are very, very familiar with trying to sort out visas to come to this country. I think every single one of us has dealt with this problem. So, Agon, I'm sorry it was as problematic as it is, but I think you'll find that most people in this room have a lot of sympathy for how difficult it is. I know very well from personal perspectives. But lovely to have you here with us this evening. Now, Agon is Associate Professor at Tetovo University and also teaches at Southeast European University in Skopje. During 2006 to 2010, he served as ambassador of the Republic of what is now North Macedonia to the Kingdom of Sweden. He's also been engaged as an advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Kosovo. Agon.
Chris. Good evening, everybody. It's not only a pleasure, but also a privilege to speak here tonight. And I thank everybody for attending this book launch. My chapter was somehow different from other chapters because I had to somehow try and integrate all these countries, engaged or not engaged, recognized or not recognized, into one Kosovo's perspective. From the very beginning, after declaring independence, Kosovo made consolidation of its statehood a high priority or strategic objective. And this was supposed to be achieved through advancement of its international position and through lobbying for recognition of its sovereignty. Therefore, very soon after February 2008, Kosovo basically created its Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which was one of two ministers that were not created during the Andrić administration, and dispatched its ambassadors in those that were important recognizing countries. The idea was to basically lobby in cooperation with Western partners, most notably US and UK, and gain as much recognition as possible as early as possible. The first year turned out to be pretty successful, and basically Kosovo received 53 recognitions. But soon enough, the momentum was lost and the number of recognitions was going down, and nowadays it is completely blocked. The idea was to see what were the reasons for such reality, and what has Kosovo foreign policy makers and diplomacy undertaken in order to deal with this issue. Basically, after the ICG ruling, which was considered pretty favorable by all Kosovo politicians, failed to yield expected increased number of recognitions, the Kosovo Ministry of Foreign Affairs formulated the strategy for full international recognition, which was a very concise document with first-hand information how to target certain regions and states in order to lobby for recognition. Unfortunately, it failed, first of all, because of the lack of interinstitutional coordination, which was foreseen in the strategy, and also due to turf battles between political individuals who were dealing with foreign policy in order to get credit for their recognition activities. This strategy was combined with a pretty overwhelming public diplomacy efforts that basically aim to fill the knowledge gap between Kosovo on the one hand and the non-recognizing countries, first of all, the five EU ones, and to also build initial bridges between Kosovo and these countries. However, despite certain initial successes, the public diplomacy efforts also failed because there was no strategic thinking behind it and there were no follow-up activities undertaken. Still, I believe that one has to give credit to Kosovo diplomacy, having in mind the task they were facing. Once the universal recognition by UN membership has failed, the new and inexperienced Kosovo diplomacy had to embark on a task of lobbying for recognition to each individual state, which by itself a very cumbersome task. The EU did not make it easier because it refused to collectively recognize Kosovo, but it left to member states to do it individually. And as a result, today we have still five EU countries that don't recognize Kosovo. Add this to two permanent members of the Security Council, then one can say that the recognition process has not been as successful as at least Kosovo would like to see. This being the fact, also one has to take into account several problems and challenges that the foreign policy of Kosovo, but also diplomacy in particular, was facing throughout this more than 10 years process. Lack of coordination, individualized and politicized lobbying, and very often deep internal political crises all have contributed to pretty humble or modest results in the last several years. Add to this the fact that the Western partners, UK, US, are now basically turning their attention to other geopolitical problems, the recognition lobbying has been blocked last 2-3 years. I just want to mention shortly the Brussels Agreement, because I believe that that's one of the external factors that has contributed the most to impeding the recognition process. Namely, on the one hand, the Brussels Dialogue has given an excuse to all non-recognizing countries to not proceed with eventual recognition because they are waiting to see what the end result of the Brussels Dialogue will be. On the other hand, without a clear time framework, without a clear aim, what the dialogue wants to achieve, it has basically prolonged the overall sovereignty of Kosovo into entire territorial population by giving additional excuses to countries that would eventually go for recognition. Nowadays, the dialogue itself is blocked, so we are waiting to see when it will proceed and what would the end result would be. But I believe that whatever recognition efforts are undertaken right now, they will be in vain before an agreement is achieved between Kosovo and Serbia. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Agon. Should we swap order? Do you want to say a little bit about Germany?
Sure. And, you know, if you want me to go first.
So let me introduce Julia Himrich, who delighted to be joining us on the panel this evening. Julia did her PhD here at LSE. I'm hoping it was a good experience. In fact, actually, I was her supervisor, and so was one of my star students. And so when the project started and we wanted somebody to do Germany, it just sort of really, she was just reminding me, was just finishing the PhD at the time, so it was the freshest of knowledge. But I think she was saying that I'd sent an email inviting her to take part in this project on the very same day as I sent a huge email with, it wasn't as many corrections as you said. But anyway, it's lovely to have Julia with us. So she holds a PhD from here at LSE, and she currently is attached to the Dahrendorf program here at the LSE. After her PhD, she was a research fellow on European defence at the European Leadership Network, the ELN, and taught on European and German foreign policy at King's College London. Julia.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you everyone for coming, and thanks again for to James and Johannes for inviting me on the project. As James said, this followed quite well from my PhD project that was actually on Germany's recognition of Kosovo. So I'm just going to highlight a couple of points here, and then maybe we can pick up some things later in the discussion, because there are a lot of interesting case studies we're going to be presenting today. I think Germany is an interesting case because now there is just a lot of interest in Germany in the Western Balkans. But if we actually want to understand Germany's attitude towards Kosovo, as so often with German foreign policy, it goes back to foreign policy identity. And the story of Germany and Kosovo is really a story of Germany finding its role in the international field after the Cold War. So we see Germany being a very small player in Europe. It was part of the Western Balkans, of the contact group, but then slowly becoming a more and more important leader in the EU, and under Angela Merkel particularly, taking really the leading role in the Western Balkans over the last 10 years. So Germany's position now, if we think of it, is that we would consider Germany a great supporter of Kosovo, a great supporter for the statehood, a great supporter for EU enlargement. And the enlargement bit is definitely true, but Germany's attitude towards Kosovo status was more complex. I'm not going to go through the whole history of it, but I think there are a couple of points to keep in mind. One is that in 2008, when Germany did recognize Kosovo, and it was one of the first ones, it was actually quite hesitant about doing that. Germany had a grand coalition government, as it does now. Angela Merkel was chancellor already, so she's been there for a long time. But you had the Social Democrats as a junior partner, and they had been in power before, and they had been very involved with Kosovo before, and they had very good relations with Serbia. And they were very concerned about the deteriorating relationship with Russia at the time, because 2008 is not just the year of Kosovan independence, it's really where the relationship between the West and Russia also broke down. So Germany were the ones that were pushing for more talks, this extension of a Troika negotiation after the Ahtisaari talk and so on. So Germany was actually not entirely sure they should be recognizing Kosovo. But then we move on and we see once Germany has recognized to really become one of the main supporters. And especially Merkel becomes the only EU leader that is willing to criticize Serbia about its Kosovo policy, to criticize the parallel structures in northern Kosovo. But again, there is a reason for this domestically. We now don't have a German grand coalition anymore. We have Angela Merkel as the senior a coalition partner with the Free Democrats that were actually quite weak on foreign policy, so the Christian Democrats were able to take the lead on that. So this is really where Merkel makes the Western Balkans policy her own. She can be much more straightforward about these things, and that's really where it takes off, where all the ideas start coming up about a Berlin process, which Germany obviously initiated. Also, and actually, that is something that came, again, from Merkel herself or her chancellor office herself, and become kind of the champion of trying to push for Kosovan statehood and more recognition as much as possible. It needs to be said that Germany was very disappointed that not all EU member states turned around afterwards and said, well, we're actually going to recognize Kosovo. But that is also where this clash with reality happens for Germany, because Germany approached the whole issue of the contested status of Kosovo as a temporary thing. They were expecting from the beginning that the prospect of EU enlargement will basically make this conflict go away. There will be a deal with Serbia, and Kosovans will be much more flexible, and also Belgrade will be much more flexible. That has not really happened, and even though Berlin has the Berlin process has been now in place for many years, and you have had the Belgrade-Pristina dialogue. Actually, the prospect for EU integration, as we all know very well, is not looking very good at the moment. So what we see now, Germany having pushed for Kosovo for a long time, actually what happened in the last year when it came to the land swap idea, they were the only ones that stood up and really openly rejected it, while, for example, in this country, there was quite a lot of support for it. And but they have been struggling to come up with alternative ideas, because for them it was always the story was the dialogue, EU enlargement will lead to peace between Belgrade and Pristina. So I think it's really important to see this development when we think of Germany's position towards Kosovo. It's very much about the idea of what the EU project should be. And looking forward, considering that Merkel's term is about to end, and we know very little about what post-Merkel Germany will look like, or what actually we should say post-Merkel EU will look like, it's quite difficult to say how this is going to develop over the next few years in terms of Germany's position. Just to highlight, to go back to this whole idea of engagement on the one side and recognition, the Germans have been pushing also Kosovo, and Aegon talked about this earlier, to really try to explain to the leadership in Pristina that there needs to be a high level of flexibility, that yes, we wanted recognition, we were not able to achieve it, full recognition by the EU, so what you need to do now is engagement. And they were the ones that really pushed for, and James will talk about that as well, with the UK, about more membership in international organizations, convincing the Kosovans to be much more involved in lobbying to get membership in international organizations. From what I understand in Berlin, there was a bit of disappointment that Pristina wasn't as open to that, because the expectation was, well, these states have recognized us, so they should also support us at that level. So there was a bit of the relationship between Berlin and Pristina also suffered a little bit because of that, because there was just this a sense that there was an expectation that the big recognizers would be able to deliver for Kosovo in this regard, but they just simply weren't, because of the complicated world of international diplomacy that I don't have to explain to you. So I think to just stop here, because I might have already touched on my 5 minutes, I think I will, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Julia. Before handing on, I thought I'd just say a little bit about the UK, in that, of course, it was a very interesting case study to do, because in many ways we know that the UK had been the strongest supporter of Kosovo in the European Union. And so, you know, you can look at various points in the development of the story, and you can see that the UK was very active in it. But what I was trying to do is get a sense of, as we were writing this, what the UK's position was on pushing for further recognitions, because it was clear that something had changed. It wasn't quite as active as it had once been. And so it was really a case of trying to speak with foreign policy makers here to understand what was going through their minds. And really what emerged was a story of four key changes that had occurred, which made it more difficult as they saw it to be quite as active in pushing for recognition. I have to say very clearly now, this doesn't mean that, you know, the UK had given up on Kosovo, far from it. It was still where it saw opportunities to push Kosovo's case. It was taking those opportunities. What we were seeing is less of a proactive bilateral lobbying effort. And they said that this really came down to four specific factors. The first was that they just said, look, we have to acknowledge it's just so much more difficult now. The low-hanging fruit, as they said, of the countries that were open to recognition had all been picked. It was much more difficult to now work with the countries that hadn't recognized. And they actually sort of, if you look back, you can see that in the first few months and the first few years, in actual fact, after Kosovo declared independence, every time a foreign secretary would go abroad, they would bring up the subject of recognition if they were going to a country that hadn't recognized. And you just see this in the records. It's very, very clear that that was the case. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest this. But then that started to tail off. And as one official said to me, the trouble is, you know, once you've asked a small Caribbean state five times, please recognize Kosovo, and they don't, it actually starts to damage Britain's standing. Because if it can't persuade a small Caribbean country to recognize Kosovo, then what is it going to be able to do? And so they said it was actually becoming detrimental and embarrassing to the UK in order to press this point. So they felt they needed to dial it back a little bit. The second one was that they were very aware that at the time we were putting this together, there was quite a lot of internal political disruption going on in Kosovo. And some of this got very negative worldwide coverage. So, for example, when Veta and Dossier were letting off tear gas canisters in the Kosovo parliament, that was actually being reported by people like BBC, CNN. That was getting a lot of worldwide attention. And you're saying, you know, when your foreign policy is to say, look, please recognize Kosovo because it's stable, it's democratic, and then they'd see these pictures on the news, that wasn't helping matters. And so they said, look, you know, this actually did have a negative effect at the time, and maybe something for... assuming that, you know, he's sworn in very soon, that the new prime minister will actually think a little bit about, you know, that side of how political stability runs very much hand in hand with efforts to persuade on recognition. The third issue is just changes in the international environment. We have really seen, again, going back to 2008, you would see, and I think people forget, Kosovo was incredibly high on the international agenda in 2008. It really was a lead story internationally. We now see, obviously, an incredibly different world. You know, different issues are gathering people's attention. Syria, for example, Ukraine. These are all stories that have overtaken. And as we talk a little bit in the book, Paul Ivan, who did the Romania chapter, and Milan Niciu did the Slovakia chapter, will both say that, in actual fact, events in Ukraine actually did a lot of harm in terms of persuading those two countries, which at one point looked like they might be on the verge of changing their position on recognition. They then stepped back after what happened in Ukraine and became much more cautious about recognizing Kosovo. And then the fourth and last point on this is, of course, Brexit. We see how, you know, to use the buzzword, it eats every little bit of bandwidth of UK policy. Now, so there just isn't, you know, the Foreign Office are tied up with thinking, right, okay, how are we going to deal with Brexit? How are we going to forge new relationships? You know, it's all focused on this. And so, you know, their ability to go out and try and, when they're trying to do trade deals with various countries, to bring Kosovo into the picture, obviously just isn't quite as much as it was. But just to end, on the other hand, what really stood out, and I see Heroina in the audience here, and you know, from her time here in the UK, is that of all the countries, I think it's probably clear to say that Kosovo probably has the highest overall profile in the UK than it does in any other EU member state. And I say that advisedly, knowing, of course, that there's a very large Albanian and Kosovo-Albanian population in Germany. But, you know, I remember when we were talking about the cultural impacts, for example, and I was mentioning some of the, you know, the famous stars who are so, you know, famous here and in the United States, and some of the colleagues from Europe hadn't heard of them, which I found in, they have now. But, you know, at that point, we're really, and it was very, very telling. So on that level, trade is not a great area to talk about, but certainly I think what you can see is that there's a very, very high awareness in the UK about Kosovo, and that's very, very strong. But in terms of the formal diplomatic process, and again, I don't want to say that Britain doesn't try and do anything for Kosovo anymore, but there's definitely been a change, and these were the factors that I think were underpinning that change. I shall pass the floor now to Yaroslav Wishnevsky, another very familiar face here at LSE. Yaroslav was a former visiting fellow here at LSE. He's an academic and political analyst, and he's worked in both the private and the public sectors. He previously worked for the Polish Embassy here in London, and he's now and then was at the Polish Institute for Foreign Affairs, and is now back here living in the UK. Jarek.
Thank you very much. Just a few words then about the Polish case study. Polish case study, as was mentioned earlier, Poland being one of the soft recognizers. So back in 2008, Poland actually recognized Kosovo's independence, but didn't really follow up with more engagement. Talking about this, I have to talk about very quickly about why the Polish foreign policy approach, where since the transition 1989 going to 1990, there were two main, on the axis of foreign policy priorities, there were two main directions going to the West, so EU enlargement and joining the NATO. On the East, stabilization of the former Soviet Union countries, and obviously the biggest threat being the Russian foreign policy, which very much determined Polish approach to the Balkans on the axis looking west and east. South wasn't really high on the list of priorities. So in fact, we had a lot of actual engagement in terms of presence of Polish troops, including Polish troops part of KFOR mission in Kosovo, or Polish policemen who are part of the mission in Mitrovica. It wasn't really backed up or followed up with any long-term strategy or strategic thinking as to how this can be used, how could this be translated to anything else. 2008 and the moment of recognition plays a pivotal role here, and it actually still, all of the events and all of the agreements that took place back then still resonate today. So in 2008, Poland did recognize Kosovo, but it did not establish diplomatic relations. Which sounds very funny. This is not something that happens very often in international politics. This was a result of a compromise between the president, representing law and justice, Lech Kaczyński, who was an opponent of Kosovo's recognition, claiming that whatever happens in Kosovo may then be repeated in Georgia in terms of Abkhazia-Ossetia, in Moldova in terms of Transnistria, or Ukraine in terms of Crimea. So he basically was worried that this would create a precedent that then can be used by Russians in order to exploit differences and different separatist movements in the former Soviet Union. On the other hand, the Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who recently finished his mission as the head of the European Council, was arguing that Poland should be in line with the US and the EU, so the main actors who are actually pursuing the idea of recognition. This is a reason why Poland recognized Kosovo later than the majority of the big players from the EU or the US. It was several days, if I'm not mistaken, around 2 weeks, 2 weeks later. And agreements that were reached then are still continued until now. Over the years, and we are talking about 11 years since, 11 years, is that?
Yeah.
11 years, more than 11 years. There was always talk about making a step further, establishing actually diplomatic relations or establishing a office, a presence in Kosovo. Because there was arguably a need for it. The economic ties are growing when you look at yearly numbers. There's still Polish troops part of KFOR. There are Polish policemen. There's increasing number of Polish tourists going there. So theoretically, one might assume that there is a reason behind establishing actually some kind of diplomatic presence in Kosovo. But this actually was never followed back by the actual action. So if I were to summarize Polish-Kosovo relations, I would say they are stable, but they are weak. It seems that status quo is something that's very satisfying from the Warsaw's perspective. there's not much interest, there's not much interest, and there's not much will in order to change it. This year is actually an example of two, one might call, wasted opportunities in terms of one big engagement of Poland and Kosovo, one of them being the non-permanent seat of Poland at the United Nations Security Council, the other being the presidency of Poland hosting the summit, Berlin Process Summit in Poznań. One was assuming before that these two events might be reasons for bigger engagement, especially the summit in Poznań, which was meant to show bigger Polish engagement in the wider region of Western Balkans. Again, it seems that there was not much bigger interest behind increasing this engagement going forward, actually establishing some sort of permanent diplomatic presence. I talk mainly about negatives, but there are positives. One, Poland is very much engaged in the region. On a bigger scale, on a smaller scale, one example is the Enlargement Academy, which is an idea where Polish civil servants train civil servants from different countries from the region, including Kosovo, in terms of preparing countries for the eventual EU enlargement. Second, presence of Polish troops, Polish policemen. Third, growing economic ties. Poland is one of the strongest supporters of EU enlargement, which also includes, obviously, Kosovo, and are supporters of the dialogue between Belgrade and Pristina. But it seems to be that there's not much will, at least at this point, in order to take these relations anywhere forward.
Thank you, Jarek. Yes, Greece.
So the Greek case. So we have, you had in the book five non-recognizers, the Greece, Romania, Slovakia, Cyprus, and Spain. And I seem to be here as a representative of the non-recognizing group, but that would be exactly the thing that Greek diplomacy would caution against. So Greece does not want to be seen as forming a group with the rest of the non-recognizers. So there is, in the Greek view, there is no EU5, EU bloc of non-recognizers. So these are individual cases, and each country has its own policy on the issue. They're not a bloc. And why does Greece like to emphasize that? It's simply because Greece is a soft non-recognizer, as we mentioned, together with Romania and Slovakia, and in fact is the most engaged non-recognizer, was seen at the time as the country possibly the one that would lead the way to Romania and Slovakia by recognizing first among these soft non-recognizers. And Greece was close to recognition as well, was as close as ever to recognition for a couple of years, 2013, 2014. Jarek mentioned the presidency or chair of whatever it's called of the Berlin process. Greece had the chair of the presidency of the European Council, 2014, and there was some debate whether Greece could recognize before the start of the presidency of the European Council or after. Anyway, this did not happen. But Greece is the most engaged non-recognizer, and it's interesting that I speak right after Jarek. Poland has recognized Kosovo, that they don't even have an embassy in Kosovo. Greece does have a diplomatic representation in Kosovo, and quite an active one. And I will speak about that in a minute. Why? First of all, very importantly, Greece has the most advanced relations with the region. Speaking about Cyprus or Spain, they're very far away, or even Slovakia to some extent, or Romania, from the region. Greece is very much involved in the region. All sorts of multivalent relations, economic, political, social, very much engaged with the region, with disputes, with friendships, with all sorts of interests, and so on and so forth. The non-recognition of Kosovo, I think, is a legacy of the 1990s policy towards on the Yugoslav question. Greece was a very partisan country with a very, very partisan views, again, in opposition, was a country that supported Serbia in this whole mess of the collapse of Yugoslavia and the wars, despite the fact that Greece has recognized the independence of Slovenia, Croatia, and the rest. Still, they were very close to Serbia, and they were kind of in minority in the European Union. And that has created a legacy which stays to this day, to some extent. The key concerns for Greece was Cyprus and Serbia. Cyprus being the Cyprus problem, division of the island, invasion by Turkey, and so on and so forth, which you know very well, of course, is one of the key not determinants, but issues of that influence heavily Greek foreign policy. So you can track the Cyprus question together with Turkey threat in the Greek eyes to pretty much all the foreign policy issues. So Greece has a foreign policy when an issue is connected to these problems. So the Kosovo issue being a separatist or independence movement is seen through the lens of Cyprus problem, and of course Serbia, because Greece in one way or another has invested a lot in this friendship with Serbia, even in difficult times in the 1990s when it was very unpopular to support Serbia. And also Serbia has a very strong presence, economic interaction, all sorts, all the way you mentioned the pop stars, all the way to football, Serbian personalities, sportsmen, and so on and so forth. Household names in Greece, so very strong relations with this country. Having said that, Greece is in the region, has very close relations and very complex relations with Albania and the Albanian nation in general. So this legacy of the 1990s had to be counterbalanced somehow with engagement with Kosovo and recognizing the reality of independence of Kosovo. So it became a fascinating case of non-recognition, but at the same time, very, very intense engagement, which so far has stayed short of recognition. And there is a debate whether, or there has been a debate over the years, whether Greece's policy can be characterized as everything but recognition. We do everything with Kosovo except recognition, or whether this is actually step-by-step recognition. And depending on who you talk to in Athens, they will say, well, we will do everything except recognize, and others would say, well, this is a process that leads to recognition. So there's two different ways of seeing these things. My chapter focused on the mechanics of this engagement policy. So how do you actually engage intensively with a state that you don't recognize? There are all sorts of details, some of which I couldn't put in the actual chapter because of lack of space. How do you do correspondence, for example? Our ambassador, we are represented in Kosovo with the rank of ambassador. So it's a senior diplomat heading the liaison office in Kosovo, very active, very present everywhere. Our ambassador goes to the parliament of Kosovo follows the deliberations in the parliament, meets very regularly with all the top politicians. It's very strange, given that we don't recognize this country. So it's a very strange engagement policy. So there are this kind of, how do you do this, actually? How do you actually communicate with the ministries of a state that you don't recognize? All these details. Greece has done it, and it has a quite good image, at least its diplomacy in Kosovo, because of that engagement, which is quite different from Spain or Cyprus. The policy dialogue back home in Greece is quite advanced. It does include the question of whether Greece should recognize Kosovo, and there are certain very influential pro-recognition voices. So it's not that this is unthinkable. I mean, there are policy debates, policy discussions where people raise openly the issue we should recognize Kosovo. But here, and with that I will close, I have to stress that there is quite a big distance between, on the one hand, the views, the opinions, discussions, debates of the expert community, IR people, foreign policy experts, etc. Those in the know, those who follow Greece's policy, and they know that Greece is so active in Kosovo. The foreign policy apparatus, like the diplomats, the secretary generals of the ministry, all sorts of diplomats, they're all very open about these issues. or what is being discussed behind closed doors, either by politicians or by experts. In that group, this is a very commonplace discussion, and it's a very advanced discussion. It's not about whether we should recognize Kosovo, but when. Or in some cases, what do we get in return? There is debate, for example, we should put this in a basket of negotiations with Albania. We should get something from Albania for recognizing Kosovo. Or others say, well, no, we should actually focus on Kosovo and increase our influence in Kosovo rather than merging Kosovo and Albania in two, which is, of course, not something that Greece would like to see in the future. So there is the distance between these people in the know, as you can call them, and then the wider political establishment. People who do not, politicians who do not do foreign policy, MPs, backbenchers, all sorts of people in politics, but not those who know and follow foreign policy, who would, if you talk to them, they would speak as if Greece is like Cyprus or Spain, like, but we don't recognize them, we don't like them, there's no connection with this country, and they're not going to be in the future any connection with this country. But these people do not know the actual operation of foreign policy. And the same applies to the public opinion. If you measure the public opinion, Kosovo is either, they're either against Kosovo or Kosovo is not visible. They don't know about Kosovo, they don't care much about Kosovo. So there is the story of relations with Kosovo is this distance between the experts, so to say, whether officials or non-officials, and the wider public and the wider political establishment for who recognizing Kosovo is as unthinkable as Spain recognizing Kosovo or Cyprus recognizing Kosovo. And this gap or this, division is very, very important, I think. And it's something to follow in the future, because these two have to come closer if ever this were to recognize Kosovo. I think that's enough, yeah?
Thank you very much, Yanis. And last but certainly not least, delighted to welcome Dr. Florian Chahaya here this evening to serve as discussant. Florian, I'm sure for many in the audience, is a very well-known figure. He's chair of the board of the Kosovar Center for Security Studies. He's the author of several scientific and policy publications in the security field and serves as an international consultant on security issues, cooperating with leading international governmental and non-governmental organizations. And he's currently here in London this year as a member of the Royal College of Defence Studies. And rather unusually, for anyone who doesn't know, this is a training institution for senior officers. And it's usually only for military or senior civil servants. And Florian had the rare and honour bestowed to come from civil society and to be attending this course. So thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks a lot, James. It's my pleasure to be here. And thank you very much for inviting me to speak on your book, which I read with great interest. And I can I would like to thank you as a Kosovan, as a think tanker, for being so objective, on your approach. And most importantly, I found the book very much evidence based, so it's very empirically driven. And I think with the growing studies on recognition, derecognition, which I see, coming up, you will serve the, all of this interest, with this book, and I believe with others. I think the invention of the book is the fact that you have managed to define the weak recognizers and soft non-recognizers. And I think this is something that the people that will study and are interested in Kosovo, and not only in Kosovo, will be interested in, because, it's not black and white. The fact that you are recognized, you don't necessarily get the support, you don't necessarily get, the vote in the international organizations, and vice versa. So I think this is something that is, as I said, an invention. When speaking about EU's approach towards Kosovo and the recognition, non-recognition stance, I would like to stress that there is one element that instantly comes to my mind in the line of the weak recognizers, soft non-recognizers, is the fact that there is an interest element. So it's not always about political standing. It's about the extent to which the countries, and in this case the EU member states, have an interest. And there are three particular interests that I could identify with respect to Kosovo from the EU member states. One is stability, you know, like which many of the EU member states see Kosovo through the angle of stability, and the fact that Kosovo's statehood is and has brought peace to the Balkans. Second is the economy and the exchange, and one of the relevant examples here is Greece, I believe, you know, like as Yanis mentioned. And third is the security cooperation, which I think in the case of Kosovo, there are most of the countries that are interested to, you know, like to extend cooperation with Kosovo, although through the non-recognition point of view. But we need to understand that it's not the political position, as I said, because we have also other countries in the region. I happen to work also in Albania at some point. I saw that also Albania is a recognized country, is a member of UN and other international organizations, but it doesn't mean that it has footprint in all of the EU member states. So it's not that, you know, like we need to see this from the angle of the political position of the countries, but rather through the position of the interest or affiliation that the EU member states have. Second aspect that I wanted to raise here is the individual and ideological element when it comes to Kosovo. And this has to do with the preference that some individuals or leaders have with respect to, in this case, Serbia, which refuses to recognize Kosovo. We have the case of existing president of Czech Republic, Miloš Zeman, for instance, or I would say even the increasing cooperation between Vučić and Viktor Orban, you know, like may have or is having to some extent some impact in the relations with Kosovo. So there is also this kind of ideological and individual element in which individually, you know, like there is more cooperation with Serbia by these kind of leaders. But on the other hand, there is these are the populist leaders which, you know, like prefer more, you know, like to have a frozen stance towards Kosovo. There are two examples of the EU's approach towards Kosovo. One is the example of the Stabilization and Association Agreement, which I think the book refers largely. And this is basically a treaty, you know, like that Kosovo signed with the EU. And the luck, in the unluck of non-recognition by five countries was that the fact that with the new EU treaties, the SAA was not supposed to be ratified by the parliaments, which was the case before, you know, like with other countries of the region, and Kosovo has managed to get the SAA, and I think this was a good example. Whereas we have other bad examples which shows the rigid position of the countries now when it comes to one of the interests that I refer to, for instance, security cooperation. Recently, there was an interest to have a strategic partnership between Kosovo and Europol, for instance, and Europol was desperately pushing forward to have strategic partnership with Kosovo because there is a security interest, you know, like in terms of exchange of information and so on. So it was basically the two strongholds, in this case, Cyprus and Spain, which refused to opt for this strategic partnership at the detriment of the EU. So there are these cases, like which, you know, like have impact in the understanding of the EU, and EU does consider these important. But while Kosovo's position internationally has been quite stagnated, I would say, and even at some point degraded, you know, like when it comes to recognition beyond EU, I think when we compare Kosovo now with 11 years ago, is that internally it got consolidation. Because a number of authors have referred to or compared Kosovo with Palestine. The main difference between Kosovo and Palestine in terms of recognition and the statehood is the fact that Kosovo has effective control in the territory. And it does so also in the northern part. I have been quite present in the northern part with projects, maybe one of the few think tankers from Pristina there, and I have seen extensively, you know, like the authority of Pristina and the footprint of Pristina in the north, which shows that in terms of the internal consolidation, there were some positive developments, and the country has full or control, you know, like of the territory, at least nominally, you know, like, although it is being supported by KFOR. So I'm saying this internal consolidation is important because it also echoes the position of the country vis-a-vis, you know, like other vis-a-vis also in the foreign policy, basically, and this has been reflected. And finally, I would say that, of course, you know, like all of these positions would be you know, like changed or expected to change if there is going to be a deal between Kosovo and Serbia. But the question is, what kind of deal we would have, and you know, like to what extent this deal would especially influence two strong non-recognizers, Spain and Cyprus. This is basically one of the main concerns that we have in Pristina and generally. So I stop here, but I look forward to any question or comment.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Florian. We've got about 25 minutes for discussion. If anyone has got a question, could I just ask one, could you just try and speak up a little bit and start by identifying yourself? So do we have any immediate questions? Everyone's gone shy. Andy. Do you want to? Can I just be really cheeky and tie in a question on this one as well? Because, Agon, you mentioned something which was very interesting, if I remember, on the dialogue and how this was serving to stall recognitions. And it's very noticeable that the countries that are now saying or withdrawing their recognitions are mentioning very clearly about the existence of a dialogue. We were premature in recognizing Kosovo because there is still a political process that's going on between Kosovo and Serbia. And so how does that also fit in to this dynamic of restarting the dialogue? Is Kosovo in a very difficult position now that it's damned if it does restart the dialogue and damned if it doesn't?
Well, it's fiddler on the roof, actually, position, if you ask me. The problem is the dialogue started as a technical one, and then it moved to exchange of territories, which is a huge difference from technical issues. The new government will have to engage in the dialogue. I don't see it happening before March, because it's taking time to have our government, then it will take, we will have elections in Serbia, so March, April. I hope this idea of having a fast deal is dead, because a fast deal is a bad deal. It's better no deal than a bad deal. That's my opinion. If you look at what Albin Kurti is saying, basically you can see that he's moderating himself nowadays as compared to years ago. And this kind of moderation is due to the fact that he knows that he needs the support of the international community, especially the Western partners and friends, if I can say so. So he will have to get into dialogue. What we had before, we had a mismatched dialogue, because the dialogue is supposed to be by heads of state, and our president is not a head of state. We are a parliamentary democracy, so the prime minister is a head of state. And now we will have the basically prime minister, the future one, leading the dialogue as the Constitutional Court has said it clearly. Because the position of Vucic was much stronger than the position of Thaçi, if you look in terms of constitution. And this created an asymmetric dialogue without being able to deliver back home, which is why a lot of agreements have not been implemented or have been blocked. So the main challenge for the new government, the new prime minister, will be foreign policy, if you ask me. It's going to be a tough period. How it will develop, nobody knows. It's a million-dollar question, I guess. I don't know whether I managed to answer partially at least or not.
I would just say that from a Brussels or member state perspective, I think there is a lot of confusion now also because we don't have a clear position on the dialogue anymore within the institutions. So with Mogherini having endorsed to some extent the land swap idea, we are not quite sure what Brussels actually thinks. And Berlin is trying to contain that and try to rein things back in, but they realize it's kind of now very difficult to do that. Another aspect of, in terms of asymmetry that Agron mentioned, there was a bit of an idea that now, before Serbia was actually being put under a lot of pressure when it came to Nadrun, but actually now on paper Serbia is way ahead of Kosovo, right? So maybe now with what Macron has done, we're a step back again, that nobody knows what's going to happen now, right? So in a way, maybe it's not just Kosovo that is insecure about its enlargement prospect, but also Serbia is now insecure, and we don't really know yet what the consequences of that is. And the last thing I would say is what the Germans have done and lots of other actors is they didn't just get involved in the diplomatic process, they were also involved in the politics of Kosovo. And I think that's now coming back to bite them because, you know, it's difficult to really, keep the... There's a lot of, people are a bit tired about Brussels or Berlin telling them who to vote for, who should be in government and things like that. And they will need to also invest in building bridges now, even though it might be difficult for Svetlana.
Just briefly on this point, I don't think we will be less consumed with if we abandon the dialogue or if we don't give the attention. I think we will be also consumed if we just don't deal with it, because I think that will, organically consume us. It's such a waste of energy for both countries, but especially for Kosovo, to engage, in bilateralism, and pushing, in with the growing populism and so on, which is not in favor of Kosovo. That I don't buy the argument that there might be another way. I think Kosovo would survive, and would continue to develop even in the existing circumstances, but it would be much easier, if there would be a dialogue that would lead to an agreement. That what kind of agreement we would have, this is subject to discussion, because I think the reason why, among many reasons, that we ended up with a bad deals or bad suggestions on the land swap and so on, was because it was some of the EU member states believing that, this can go like this, the fact that the presidents are talking is just fine, and they would rather even opt to have some sort of agreement, which would be defined a comprehensive legally binding agreement, which would be full of ambiguity, without, any tangible result in terms of long-term solution between Kosovo and Serbia.
Don't worry, I know.
With Serbia and Kosovo, we have to take into consideration that Thaçi and Vucic are the best friends ever. This happened when Vucic and Thaçi met in Rome, and somehow the ambassador of Kosovo in Rome got fired. Something leaked. Anyway, so we know that Kosovo is very weak regarding recognition because there's nothing to offer. Serbia has a lot to offer. Weapons, students, studies for different African countries, so bribes, money, as you know, is not something new. So comparing Kosovo and Serbia and fighting for recognition biased or unbiased. However, recognition issue, from Italy, yes, if you ask people, if you ask citizens, maybe they don't know where Kosovo is. But this is for internal political issues, like, I don't know, nation targets here, but they have internal political goals, like Serbia, and you guys, Serbia has to fight an enemy, just say something for Kosovo. So internal political and citizens in Serbia wonder, like, they want something, and they give Kosovo. And to close it, last question. I don't know how many countries recognize and how many don't. Recognition. Can someone tell me?
15.
Oh, Misha, I'm gonna, I'm really, all right.
Okay. I'm a native of Belgrade, one of the hard non-recognizers, right? On the question of recognition, there is more than just Kosovo and Serbia. I mean, what is involved is the way that this whole thing has come about. And if I can just remind you that in 1999, 13 NATO states have formed the then Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, have bombed themselves into Kosovo. The United States, which led the whole operation, almost instantly started building the largest military base in Europe at Camp Bondsteel. This just gives you an idea that this is well beyond the Balkans, which is now pretty much all NATO territory, with the Western Balkans and Serbia outside it. But recognition, unfortunately, means more than just relations with Kosovo, including an independent one. It means recognition that what NATO has done is okay. And they have all flagrantly breached the UN Charter. Germany, for the first time since May 1945, at war with Serbia. The same for Britain. The same for the others. So this is a big issue, and if there is one issue that I can mention now, very important thing that has happened, I'm not going to be much long, this is Russia, of course, which has now stood behind Serbia, so their views has to be taken into account. And the big issue is Crimea, because they have taken control of Crimea, have annexed it, and they have now Putin and others are quoting Kosovo. Look what you've done with Kosovo. What we are doing now with the Crimea is something similar, but in fact much lower. We didn't have to drop 22,000 tons of bombs, which is what NATO did in 1999. So maybe some this issue, Crimea and Kosovo, and just if I can add, isn't there a possibility that the two superpowers will come together and say, okay, you have Kosovo, we'll have Crimea?
Who wants to start?
Well, we haven't had the question yet.
Yeah, so. Take three.
We need a question to start speaking. Jesse wanted to ask.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask that.
You were, you got what you want.
Speaking a lot, and actually, you, James, as well, you were speaking a lot about domestic.
thank you very much, Jesse. In fact, actually, I'll hand to Jarek, but one quick point, which before was just to say that it really was fascinating that the Czech Republic and Poland were the two where we found that domestic link, I think, was absolutely paramount in it. But what I think was so interesting, Jarek will talk about the Polish case, is how even though there's been massive political changes in both countries, the decisions that were taken in 2008 haven't been able to be changed. And maybe, Jarek, you can sort of talk a little bit about that in the Polish case.
It was very much about internal politics. Poland is an interesting case because it wasn't something that was really sort of measured, polled in Poland. I did find interesting examples of polls from around the time of the intervention, 1999, where you had overwhelming support of the Polish society for Poland joining the intervention in Yugoslavia. So this was the only polling that I was able to pull around the issue of Kosovo. We didn't really have polling done in Poland about engagement, about there was support for recognition, but later on about establishing diplomatic relations, et cetera, because it's difficult to explain difference between recognition and not establishing diplomatic relations in general. So this is something way too complex, I think, to just to simplify it. But in Polish case, it was very much result of the domestic dynamics, because back in 2008, Lech Kaczyński, Law and Justice, and sort of his political party were against recognition and against establishing diplomatic relations. Since 2015, they are in power, now winning elections this year again. And there seems to be support for continuing it. Kosovo usually appears on the fringes, of the far-right fringes, so football supporters, which is also linked with organized crime, and supporters from the major Polish football teams cooperating closely with supporters from major Serbian football teams, mainly in issues around organized crime. But whenever these issues approach, there's always banners saying Kosovo is Serbian in all possible languages. So one of the things is also the rise of populism and the rise of, I would say, influence within the current ruling elite, growing influence of people who tend to have either more nationalistic, more pan-Slavic general sort of thinking, which definitely is one of the factors why status quo seems to be comfortable, convenient right now, and there's not much willingness to actually change it. So it's very much about, yes, about, well, the society, or at least part of the society that's somehow influencing the political regime, the current political regime, not to go forward.
I'll take a quick, unless have you got a pressing?
No, I was thinking to maybe comment on what just, well, unless if you have other plans.
No, I'm just wondering, because we've got about 10 more minutes, and just whether to take if there are any more questions, get them in now. All right, Richard at the back, and then. Thank you. Could you perhaps just identify yourself?
Sorry, yes, I'm a child. I used to come to the LC. So, firstly, thank you so much. It's been really interesting. So, I don't really have much knowledge of international relations and that kind of thing, but my question really is, as I said, it's probably quite obvious one, but what I've always been interested in is why there's such an interest academically into Kosovo and, you know, especially Western intervention in the war. And again, like I said, it might be part of this, but I quite like somebody to kind of explain that to me.
Yes, exactly, Julia. What are we doing? Why have we spent so much time looking into this issue? Have we got one? Maris at the back.
Maris, Regis and Rose, thank you. Thanks for
Are there any final pressing? Speak now. All right. Okay. Should we just go in order? Agon, do you want to start and just pick up on any of the points that you'd like to just tackle?
Well, I didn't really understand the question about North Macedonia, so I missed something.
Okay.
Is it a Macron decision of bad news or accession of North Macedonia to NATO bad news?
Yes.
I mixed up somehow.
Sorry, the position is that just not the reality of what's coming ahead, in that actually it's a wider, it'll be a wider debate about the organisation in the EU that ultimately will influence Kosovo's desire to accede to the EU, and that the reality is the indications of the North Macedonian attempt to get to NATO is just a preview to that.
Well, in my opinion, Kosovo is the last in terms of EU integration by far. So basically, what Macron's decision and this idea of new non-paper will affect those who are closer. We don't even know whether it will affect Montenegro and Serbia. It has blocked for the time being North Macedonia and Albania. Bosnia and Kosovo are at the very end. So I think it affects them the least, if you ask me. The NATO admission, I think it's a good news for the region. Basically, we are slowly closing the circle, except Serbia that doesn't want to get there. The entire region is becoming a NATO member, which I think is good for collective security of the region, which is full of troubles historically. There was a question earlier about whether Kosovo will negotiate with this reality. If you ask me, Serbia would lose more of incentives to negotiate or proceed the dialogue than Kosovo, because Serbia was getting, after each round of agreements reached, a step further or closer to EU. Now this has been stopped or blocked. So I don't know how it will go. About the perceptions, I mean, I have in the chapter, but I had 5 minutes, so one has to prioritize. There have been a lot of internal problems, deficiencies, and other things that have basically damaged the image of Kosovo abroad. By damaging the image of Kosovo abroad, you directly somehow damage the process of recognition as well. Because tear gas in the parliament, high level of perceived corruption, that's how they love to call it, nepotism in diplomacy and political ranks, political crisis of every cycle of elections. These are all things that make it difficult for lobbyists to convince that it's a functional democracy as such. If those things would have been in a better manner handled, I think that the recognition would have gone better as well. But this is the reality we have to deal with. About the polls, I don't know, actually. These are other countries that might have something like that. But that's up here.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe I picked from on the point that was mentioned earlier about the dialogue, and someone asked about the dialogue and what is the impact on policies. I think it's twofold. When dialogue started with Serbia and intensified, I think it gave arguments to those non-recognizers that really wanted to engage. I mean, those who didn't want to engage, they can't be convinced. But those who wanted to engage, like Greece, I mean, they gave them an additional argument for engagement. Like, just to give you one example, the Serbian diplomacy, which is very active in Greece, always complains when there's something we do with Kosovo. And then, you know, the simple answer is, well, your president meets with Kosovo leadership every second month. I mean, why would, and you don't recognize, you're a hard recognizer, as the gentleman put it. So why wouldn't we meet with Kosovars? I mean, why not? So, but I would say in the way that the dialogue evolved in the last couple of years, when it has became a kind of the atmosphere or that
that we are close to reaching an agreement. There will be an agreement. There is an agreement that Thatcher and Vučić have reached, and it's only a question of how to shove it down to people's throats. And this is actually something that would keep non-recognizers away from any movement, because if Serbia can resolve this problem and take the hot potato out of Greece and Slovakia and Romania, then of course we would wait not 1 or 2 years but 10 years for Serbia to resolve the problem, and then we can go in and recognize after the Serbs. So in a sense, as long as there is a dialogue and an expectation that the dialogue will lead to some sort of solution, I think non-recognizers are happy. They can continue to engage and wait for Serbia and Kosovo to agree. Now the question is, what happens if this dialogue fails? And this will not be such an acute problem for Spain and Cyprus, because they don't have much to do with the Balkans anyway. It will be an acute problem for Greece, because for example, Greece will not want a failing state in Kosovo, because failing state will mean it will be, you know, merged with Albania, it will be a domino effect failing state in North Macedonia. So Greece will have a dilemma. Well, this state, you don't recognize it, but it's good that it's there, so you have to do something to keep it there. So these are all dilemmas that will be of the day after, if dialogue with Serbia fails. But I think it's pretty obvious that non-recognizers hope that Serbia and Kosovo reach an agreement soon, so that all this hot potato, it is a hot potato for many countries, will get out of the way. When it comes to the polls, if I have one more minute or not, yeah. When it was the intervention in Yugoslavia, 1999, I think Greece was probably the only EU member state that was against the intervention, 97%.
More than Serbia.
Having said that, without Greek military facilitation, intervention in Yugoslavia would have been very difficult. So Greece was NATO member state that a very crucial real estate in the Balkans, through which the land forces entered in the area of former Yugoslavia. So there was a lot of military facilitation, which was done by a very pro-Western, pro-European government at the time, despite the fact that we had demonstrations every second day in Greece against the war. So it was a difficult balancing act for the Greek government back then. We did a poll in recent year, in 2015, 2013, 14, I don't know, in Greece about the recognition. The majority is against, but not overwhelmingly against. I mean, it's, I think, probably 60-40 or 65-35, I can't remember the exact numbers. One of the reasons that people are against it is because they see Kosovo as an American project, and there is a high anti-Americanism in Greece. You know, we don't like Americans that much. Now we like them more. Maybe they will change their opinion. But if this is an American project, we don't like it. But overall, I think the more you go further towards the extreme left or extreme right, there you have hardened opinions on Kosovo, like the far right, Golden Dawn, far left, Stalinist parties. They are very much anti-Kosovo because they are nationalists, they are pro-Russian, you name it. But the more centrist parties, which are the mainstream parties for most of the time, they're more flexible, so to say. And last but not least, something I cannot remember now, so it's okay. It's
Julia.
Next time, yeah.
Okay, just very quickly to Jesse and Marius. So domestically in Germany, they focus always on the elites, on the parties. The general public has not been very involved in the decision making. Important to notice also that German attitude towards the Western Balkans, very focused on containing migration as much as possible since the 90s. That's really the lens they use for the Western Balkans. Also, very different from the UK, there's not much diaspora politics in generally. It's very difficult in Germany if you're an immigrant to get involved in politics to have any effect. So even though we have quite a lot of immigrants from the Western Balkans, You know, that like other big groups like you know, Turkish, Italian, or Portuguese or Spanish, very little influence actually. So it's quite different from here. And the other thing that's different from the UK is there's not that great, you know, we're not very proud of 1999. It's very controversial still, so it's also difficult to kind of frame recognition in connection with 99. There's not this liberation discourse that you have here in the UK. And finally, to Marius, very, very reluctant to engage with those issues. Generally, the Germans want to treat Kosovo as like a black box. It's about the independence of this, you know, that state and that entity. And I think also in Brussels, people in general, I find very reluctant to engage with the issues of minorities in the countries, much more than in other Western Balkan countries.
Okay, so quickly about Macron. He was very, very, very heavily criticized in Poland, both for his statement around NATO being brain dead and the decision to block Macedonia's and Albania's enlargement. Strongly criticized by politicians, experts. Poland still maintains that it is supporting EU enlargement and NATO enlargement. NATO enlargement, obviously, to increase security, also to decrease Russian influence in the region of Western Balkans. Though I have to underline that foreign policy as such, it's not very much present in domestic debate in Poland. So even though the society seems to be saying in all Eurobarometer polls that they are supporting enlargement, it's not really supported by any debate about pros and cons of enlargement, what are the consequences of enlargement, or overall foreign policy debate. That's why I wouldn't pay that much attention. I would always add an asterisk whenever talking about Polish society's thoughts about enlargement policy, because they are not really supported by any substantial domestic debate around it. But at least numbers for now show that society is supporting both enlargements. Yeah.
Quickly on Macron, Richard's question. I think the reality check of Kosovo's difficulties as a result of the French position is the visa liberalization process. It was because of France, and actually North Macedonia and Albania was supposed to look the trend of France's position, and we should not forget Dutch position as well, which is maybe even stronger when it comes to visa liberalization process for Kosovo. For those that don't know, Kosovo has fulfilled all criteria in the last 2-3 years, and EU still refuses to deliver. Although for that, it doesn't need to take, you know, like support of 27 members now without UK, but it needs, you know, like a majority of 65%. And because France does qualify, you know, like a big portion of in that 65%, it is basically using veto. So I think Kosovo is just healing like France's position and Macron's position on this issue.
We will finish up, but does anyone want to answer this lady's question as to what we're all doing here?
Yeah. Nothing better to do.
It rather puts us on the spot, but very good question. But I think what we've tried to do, certainly in the book, is just show that, you know, Kosovo is a fascinating case, because obviously its declaration of independence was very controversial. It's divided international opinion, and what we're trying to do is understand how the international community has responded to that, and really show that this understanding that existed of recognizers and non-recognizers on the world stage doesn't even begin to tell the true story. And it is fascinating. We just looked at the European countries, but there's a whole book to be done on other countries, and it's split. So Greece is anti-American, and so there's a popular strand of opinion that doesn't accept Kosovo because they see it as an American project. Iran is exactly the same. So while many Muslim countries have recognized Kosovo, Iran is a strong holdout precisely because it sees it as a, you know, and you see how some countries will recognize Kosovo passports but won't engage in other ways. So it's a fascinating case, and I hope that in the book, and thank you very much to everyone, you know, that we try to bring this out a little bit.
So we try to get out of the five non-recognizers, and you put us together with Iran now. So, what's this deal now?
you can divide it up. There's all sorts of, you know, they're the hot, absolutely. Yeah, they go with Spain and Cyprus.
Spain and Cyprus.
Absolutely. So on the international. So thank you all very, very much for coming this evening. Really appreciate it. And you know, I'd love to say that if only this had been held yesterday, Palgrave were doing an amazing sale of £9.99 for all their, but it's back up to its usual price. I'm sorry. But
don't mention the price.
No, don't mention the price. But thank you all very much. And if you want, there is actually a report that we actually produced, lack of engagement. If you Google it, KFOS, lack of engagement, Kosovo, it was a policy report that we produced. And these are the academic long version, if you like, but the policy report actually condenses a lot of what we were talking about, and it's freely available. So thank you all very much.